NPR's Joe Palca says the study is in the latest edition of the journal Science.
The horse species is called Cephripus. It lived in Wyoming 53 million years ago. Cephripus was much smaller than modern horses. Scientists from the universities of Nebraska and Florida used fossilized teeth to estimate the horse's size over a period of about 175,000 years, when global temperatures rose by 10 to 20 degrees. They found that Cephripus shrank from about the size and weight of a small dog, like a miniature schnauzer, to about that of a house cat. When temperatures subsequently cooled, Cephripus put the weight back on. These findings could be important for estimating the effect of future climate change on animal size. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
And I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org.
Here's a fun travel opportunity coming up in May. Fly to Washington, D.C. with WILL. Come with us to the nation's capital and spend 4 days touring the city, including a stop at the NPR studios. Our trip will leave from Campbell Hall, the home of Illinois Public Media, on May 4th and return on May 9th. Call 217-333-7300 or visit our website, will.illinois.edu/willtravel for information.
WILL programs are made possible by the Champaign Park District, presenting Gaelic Storm at the historic Virginia Theater. Known for their appearance as the Celtic party band in the movie Titanic, Gaelic Storm appears at the Virginia Tuesday, March 6th at 7:30 p.m. More information is at 356-9063 or at thevirginia.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll get the story of the British effort in the early 1920s to climb Mount Everest. This was a project that the British public, hungry for heroes, followed very intently. And perhaps the greatest of all of those heroes, arguably the greatest climber of his time, was a man named George Mallory. There were three expeditions. The first, in 1921, was really all about finding the mountain and mapping out the territory. The last, in 1924, ended in Mallory's death. And to this day, no one knows whether or not he, in fact, made it to the top of the mountain. In this hour of the show, we will talk with Wade Davis. He tells the story in a recently published book. The title is Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory, and the Conquest of Everest. And Knopf is the publisher. And the book looks certainly at Mallory's story and at the story of the others who went along on these expeditions, but also takes a look at how all of these men, in fact, this entire generation, was shaped by the carnage of World War I. Wade Davis is the best-selling author of more than a dozen books, including The Serpent and the Rainbow and One River. He is an award-winning anthropologist and currently holds the post of National Geographic Explorer in Residence. And he's joining us with us this morning by phone. Questions are welcome. People can call in, ask questions. All you need to do is dial us up. In Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that, 800-222-9455. You may also send us an email if you'd like, and that's will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here, questions are welcome. We just hope people can be brief so we can get in as many folks as possible, but certainly your call is welcome. And Mr. Davis, hello.
Hello, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. Thanks for talking with us. It's a great, great story, and I'm really glad you could spend some time with us. I know that you have been to Tibet and have not climbed Everest, but have some sense of what the terrain is like and how difficult this would have been. And I think that, in fact, this book was born out of your curiosity about just why someone, anyone, would attempt this.
Yeah, your summary at the beginning of the show was terrific, David. And, you know, the fundamental story, of course, is that these three expeditions occurred. The first was a reconnaissance where they literally had to walk off the map 400 miles just to come to the flanks of a mountain that no European had seen at close quarters. And then famously on June 8th of 1924, George Mallory, age 37, and his young companion, Sandy Irvin, just 22, were seen by Noel Dell, a climber in support, cresting the northeast ridge of Everest, two dots on the skyline, when suddenly the mist rolled in and enveloped their memory in myth. And the question always was, you know, did they get to the top before they succumbed? And from the very start, I wasn't really interested in that question. I really wanted to know who these men were. And I knew from their age and their class and their backgrounds that all of them, or at least the majority of the 26 men who went to Everest on those three early expeditions, would have gone through the agony of the Western Front. And it wasn't that I was thinking that they were cavalier about death, but they had seen so much of it that death, in some sense, had no mystery for them. They had nothing more to teach them save that of their own, and they were perhaps willing to accept the degree of risk that would have been unimaginable before the war, because for that entire generation, in a sense, life mattered less than the moments of being alive. And that was the idea that I really began over 12 years ago. And curiously, the genesis of this project, and as a writer, one never knows when a moment of serendipity will sort of fling your life into some kind of incredible direction. I was traveling in the fateful spring of 1996, 4,000 miles across Tibet from western China to Lhasa and on to Kathmandu as part of an ecological survey. And we happened to go by Everest in the same month the debacle happened that John Krakauer so powerfully wrote about in his book Into Thin Air. And with me on that expedition, indeed leading that expedition, was an old friend, Daniel Taylor, who was the son and grandson of medical missionaries in the Himalaya. His own father had been a very close friend of Howard Somerville, who was Mallory's closest friend on the mountain in both 1922 and 1924. And Daniel was disturbed that the commercialization of the mountain had led to such tragic and unnecessary loss of life, because the Everest of his imaginings was the Everest of his grandfather and his father and of Mallory. And by chance, Daniel and I returned to the Everest Massif the following fall, the fall of 1997, to photograph clouded leopards and snow leopards for the National Geographic. And we got caught in unusual snow conditions. We actually thought we might be trapped in the Gama Valley in the east face of Everest for the winter. And Daniel just began to speak of these Englishmen in tweeds who read Shakespeare to each other in the snow at 23,000 feet, and I became completely enamored. But again, as I say, what really interested me was not whether they got to the top, but who these men were. And one of the things I wanted to find out is where each of them had been on every day of the Great War. Now, that may seem like an impossible task, but this war was so thoroughly documented. You know, it was famously said of both the Battle of Passchendaele, where 400,000 Englishmen would be lost in 6 months to advance the line 5 miles, or at the Battle of the Somme, where over 50,000 people, men, boys, fell on the very first day of the battle. It was famously said that the British Army lacked the clerk power to tabulate the dead. Well, if that was true, they kept records of just about everything else, and this war was so thoroughly documented that it was a wonder men found time to fight. And the other fascinating thing that people forget is how small the battle zone was for the British forces. The front line of the British sector of the front was never longer than 125 miles, and for much of the war it was as short as 85 miles. Now, behind that frontage, the British Empire, including, of course, the Indians and the Canadians, the Australians and the Brits, would build over 6,000 miles of trenches, 6,000 miles of railroad. The Ypres Salient, this bulge in the line around the old medieval cloth town of Ypres in Belgium, a salient that was only 4 miles by 12 miles, a healthy man could walk around it in a day or two. Within that cauldron of death, 1.7 million boys from both sides would die or be severely wounded during the war. And because so many millions moved through this small zone of operations, and because in the wake of the war, famously a decade after the armistice, the tsunami of literature poured out, memoirs, letters, poetry, and prose, there was literally no corner of that battlefield that wasn't chronicled every single day of the 4 years and 4 months of the war in multiple voices, the bombastic boasts of a Yorkshire sergeant or the haunting cries of a subaltern shattered by shell shock. And so it was not only possible to find out where all of our protagonists were each day of that war, but also to ascertain with some incredible level of specificity exactly what they would have been exposed to. Mm. And as it turned out, of the 26 men, six escaped the war. Sandy Irvin, famously too young, Harold Rayburn and Arthur Kellis, too old. Guy Bullock was a diplomat. Tom Longstaff set out the war in India, and Benthy Beetham was a schoolmaster in Scotland. But the other 20 men most assuredly saw the worst of the fighting. Six were severely wounded themselves. Four served as surgeons at the casualty clearing stations behind the front and dealt every day of the war with the carnage and horrors of the wounded and the dead. Two lost brothers in the war. I mean, some of them literally carried the war to Everest in the sense that Jack Hazard, who summited the North Col in 1922, did so with open bleeding wounds from the Battle of the Somme that would never heal, saturating his climbing tunic with blood. Mm-hmm. And so all of them had endured the coughing of the guns, the bones and the barbed wire, and the white faces of the dead. This doesn't suggest that they spoke about the war. The war was never spoken about by those who had lived the agonies of the front, but it was never forgotten. T.E. Lawrence, as in Lawrence of Arabia, and Robert Graves, the poet, who was a close friend of Mallory. Mallory, in fact, was his best man at his wedding. And Graves had studied at Charterhouse School under Mallory as a schoolmaster. They famously made a deal never to talk about the war, but the war hovered in their imaginings in ways that we cannot possibly imagine.
Yeah, I think this is really an important idea, you've gotten me to perhaps think more about this than I had before, even though maybe I've read a little bit of this history. And that is, you know, if you think about the military engagements that are important for shaping politics and culture, you know, maybe for somebody of our age, we're going to think about Vietnam, and people a little bit older than we are will think about World War II. But I think you're really encouraging people to think about all of the ways in which the ways that we think, that all of the elements of culture that we associate with modernity, all of that,
it all comes out of the First World War.
David, that's
such a thoughtful comment of yours, because, you know, for Americans, the Second World War kind of looms in our imaginings, sort of the great war of our fathers, so the greatest generation, as Tom Brokaw so powerfully wrote. But, you know, really, as Churchill said, the First World War and the Second World War were really one war. He called it the 30 Years' War, and he famously said, never was there a war less necessary to fight than the first, or more essential to win than the second. And what we forget is the First World War was the fulcrum of modernity. You know that bullet into the breast of a prince in Sarajevo sparked the greatest cataclysm in the history of humanity. And up until that war, the whole ethos of the 19th century, which was an idea of progress, improvement, this sort of sense of moral righteousness of European nations, for better or for worse, as they colonized the world, there was a sense that Europe had essentially been at peace since Napoleon, with a few kind of modest skirmishes like the Crimean War. But fundamentally, Europe had been at peace, even as industrialization had created military prowess that was beyond the imaginings even of the generals of the time, even as the empires had expanded until the borders of colonial ambition sort of met and in the end strangled the world. And then suddenly the cataclysm begins. And, you know, think of just some basic stuff. You know, at the outbreak of the war, for example, the British Army, you had to be 5'8" to enter the war. By the end of November, within 2 months, men 5'3" were eagerly accepted. Before the war, cremation was virtually unknown as a way of dealing with the dead in Britain. After the war, it became the preferred form of dealing with the dead for countless tens of thousands who had lived 4 years and 4 months with the stench and agony of the rotting flesh of no man's land. Plastic surgery was born of the war. And the need to repair the shell-scarred faces of young people of their lives would live behind masks and attend these special holiday camps where they could remove those masks to allow the wind to touch their gargoyle features without fear of humiliation or shame. I mean, think about this. The regular British Army and the entire British Empire required every year 2,500 shovels. In the mud of Flanders, 10 million would be required. 25,000 coal miners spent the entire war tunneling under the enemy lines to detonate these charges of TNT, which blew with such explosive force that the shock waves were felt in southern England. Every single month of the war, now think about this for David, in the entire 10 years of the Iraq War, the United States has lost roughly 4,500 boys and girls in the battles. In the First World War of the British, a war that would last 4 months and four years, that was roughly the weekly toll of the dead. Every single month, the British Army required 10,000 officers of the lower ranks simply to replace the rosters of the dead. And so all the public schools of Britain, particularly in the early years of the war, would literally graduate their senior classes directly to the front, where not to Oxford or Cambridge, but directly to the trenches. And such were the agonies of the war that in the first years of peace, fully a quarter of all English land would change hands, which represented a sort of shift of fortunes unlike anything that had been seen in Britain since the Norman conquest. And women spoke about the war in often the metaphor of dance. Nancy Cooper famously wrote that by the end of 1916, every boy I'd ever danced with was dead. Vera Brittain, who lost her brother, her fiancé, and her two best friends from university to death at the front, famously said there was simply no one left to dance with. Stephen Spender, the poet, said that in the first years of peace, the British middle class continued to dance, forgetting that the dance floor had fallen out from beneath them. And there's a wonderful passage. George Mallory's mentor was a wonderful man, Geoffrey Winthrop Young. And he was sort of the great climber of his generation. And before the war, the other thing we forget is we tend to think that the sort of stultified era of the Victorians somehow morphed right away to the kind of the madness of the jazz era of the 20s. But we forget that in the first decades of the 20th century, there was this real renaissance of poetry and art and a philosopher who had inspired many by the name of Morris, who led people like George Mallory and his comrades to really believe that all that mattered in life was authenticity and truth and transparency and new dreams and hope in this new century. And so this was a very idealistic generation of people like Rupert Brooke, all of whom got slaughtered at the front. And of course, in the wake of it, you sort of came this shock of what that had entailed for an entire people.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Wade Davis. We're talking about the story of the British expeditions to climb Everest in 21, 22, 24, and the men who were involved in this, and one man in particular, George Mallory, who was regarded by a lot of people as perhaps the greatest mountain climber of his day. This was, in fact, the man. I'm sure people have heard this famous quote. This was a man who, when asked, "Why do you want to climb Mount Everest?" he said, "Because it's there."
You know, the funny thing about that, David, is that comment came at the end of a lecture. It was first reported in the New York papers in 1923 while Mallory was on a lecture tour of the United States during Prohibition. And Mallory probably said that remark to get rid of a bothersome autograph seeker that stood between him and a good drink in a speakeasy. But the fantastic thing is that it somehow, in its essence, distilled exactly why people climb. Yeah. And I was saying about Geoffrey Winthrop Young that there's a beautiful passage. He used to gather all these young men and poets at a place called Pennypath in Wales twice a year, where they would celebrate. And by day they would climb, and by night they would sing, recite poetry, and dream all these new dreams. Now, he kept a photographic album of those Pennypath gatherings. And of the beautiful honed faces, no fewer than 23 of the climbers would be killed in the war, 11 or 12 severely wounded, never to walk again. And as Tom Longstaff famously remarked, when they began to assemble a team for 1921, the supply, he said, of climbers in Britain is not what it was before the war. And there's an incredible passage in Winthrop Young's journal from the front when he was at Ypres in April of 1915, when the Germans attacked using poison gas for the first time. And he says in his journal that you know nothing of the degradation, even of a later war in the concentration camps, came close to sort of the horror of what that attack with poison gas meant as men came stumbling back to the front, frothing at the mouth. And he ends that passage in his diary by saying, because then we still thought all men were human. And it's the most poignant kind of symbol of the fulcrum that that war brought about. And of course, in the wake of the war, it was, as you suggested in your intro piece, it was a fulcrum of the 20th century. So everything we know today, existential angst and this depression and the nihilism and alienation and the kind of the chaos that led to people like Hitler and Stalin and Mao, all of whom were children of the First World War, really came out of this breakdown of civilization that had held Europe together for so long.
Yeah. I'm certain that on the continent, they would have been many capable climbers because there are some fairly serious mountains. So I'm sure that there would have been men in Spain and in France and Austria and Germany and places like that who could have done this. So the question then becomes, why is it that this is the UK?
Well, that's a fantastic question. I mean, the initial impulse to climb Everest before the war really was a mission of national redemption for an empire of explorers who had famously lost the race to the North and the South Poles. And Everest, looming over the Raj, was seen as the third pole. And indeed, in 1920, to go to the top of Everest was almost the equivalent of going to the moon, because it's one thing to pull a sled across Antarctica on the level. It's quite another to walk into a zone of death where it was not even clear you would be able to breathe in the oxygen-deprived environment of the heights of Everest. And then, in the wake of the war, it sort of the effort morphed into a mission of regeneration for a nation led white by war. And one of the things I tried to do in this book is not only draw attention not to Maori, but to all of the 26 men on those expeditions, each one of whom was arguably as interesting, if not more interesting, than George Mallory. But also I wanted to put those expeditions in the context of their time. So they could never be separated from the political and diplomatic thrust and parry of the Great Game, for example, the great rivalry between Russia and Great Britain. Remember that Great Britain through the 19th century had been expanding on sea, the Russians on land, to the tune of 55 square miles a day for every day of the 19th century, bringing the Russian Empire to the gateways of the Raj. And in fact, the original permission to go to Everest, because of course Nepal was famously cut off and closed to the British. So the only way to approach Everest in 1921 was through Tibet. But to get permission to go through Tibet, they had to wait for some very complicated diplomatic maneuverings by a man called Charles Bell. And in the end, the permission came through from the 13th Dalai Lama as part of a diplomatic initiative that was essentially an arms deal upon which the future of a free Tibet rested. And by the same token, in the wake of the death of Mallory, efforts were immediately set in motion to climb the mountain in 1925. But the third expedition had been photographed and filmed by John Noel, and he had bankrolled the entire expedition with a loan of £8,000 in exchange for the photographic rights to the expedition. All of this hinged on the certainty that Mallory would get to the top in 1924, and when it didn't, he had to turn his film from a celebration to a kind of requiem. Mm-hmm. And to decorate or to spice up the release of the film in London, which he was seeing as a film that would compete with any film coming out of Hollywood in the time, he brought in seven monks from Lhasa, or actually from Gyantse, against the permission, or without the permission, of their abbot. And they were kind of used to decorate the stage in this kind of carnival atmosphere of exoticism. And it so offended the Tibetans that they rescinded any permission for the British to go back to Everest in 1925, shutting down access to the mountain for nearly a decade. And so at both ends of these expeditions, they were rooted in the geopolitical realities of a very interesting period of time in the descent of the Raj, the ascent of Tibet, and eventually the ascent and of China and the conquest of Tibet.
Yeah. One of the interesting parts of the story, and this you touched on the fact that the 21 expedition was really an exploration effort, because they had to map the region, they had to figure out where they were going to go, how they were going to get there, how they were going to approach the mountain, how they were going to climb it. How did they even know that it was there? And how did they figure out that it was, in fact, the tallest mountain?
Your questions, David, are absolutely brilliant, because they lead directly one from the other. Because what happened as part of that thrust and parry of the Great Game is it drove the British crazy that they had no way to have a diplomatic contact with Lhasa, the capital of Tibet, that was about 250 miles from Darjeeling, you know, a hill town that sent tea to every hamlet in the British Empire. And so when Lord Curzon could not open a diplomatic avenue to Lhasa, he became paranoid that the Russians were already there. And so in 1903, a young husband famously launched his mission, and in 1904, a full-out military assault on Tibet that kind of broke the virginity, as the British said, of this mystical capital of Lhasa in 1904. And as they retreated from that conquest, they sort of had to find a new goal, and that new goal, of course, was the shining mountain that scored the horizon above the fortress center of Tibet called Kampazong, where young husband had camped out through the failed attempts in 1903. And so as he's moving his army back to Darjeeling, he dispatches an expeditionary exploratory party up the Brahmaputra, again to map the headwaters of the Brahmaputra, known as the Tsangpo, in Tibet. And that expedition goes relatively close to the mountain. So again, they see the mountain from the north. It appears to be climbable. And so in 1921, they send the expedition. And on the one hand, they want to map the approaches, filling in the blanks on the map of the lands that hover over the Raj to the north. But the most interesting individual, in a way, in 1921, and the unsung hero of the expedition, was not George Mallory, but an obscure Canadian by the name of Oliver Wheeler, seconded to the expedition with the specific task of mapping with a new photographic topographical technique invented by his father in the Canadian Rockies, the inner massif of Everest itself. It would be Oliver Wheeler who would spend more time higher on the mountain, exposed to the wrath of the mountain, alone on the mountain, than any of the other men in 1921. Now, all of these climbers then were ridge walkers. They couldn't deal with a steep face like the North Face or the Tenshung Face. They had to get to a ridge that would lead to a ridge that would lead to the summit. And in 21, Guy Bullock and George Mallory, as part of their contribution, made a beeline for the Rongbuk Valley, which goes right up to the North Face of Everest. They knew about the valley because of reports of the legendary Rongbuk Monastery, the highest monastery of Tibetan Buddhism in the world, is at the base of Everest in the Rongbuk. And as they went to the top of the Rongbuk Glacier, they could see what they called the North Col, where the northeast shoulder of Everest came down to a saddle that then rose to another peak. And this became, as Mallory put it, the coal of our desires, because they could see that if they could get to the saddle of snow, which was not approachable from the west, not climbable, but if they could get to it somehow from the east, it seemed to lead to a shoulder that led to the northeast ridge, where, at least seen from the valley bottom, there did not appear to be severe impediments blocking the way to the summit pyramid. And so the whole quest in 1921 was to find the way to get to the summit of the North Col, the doorway of the mountain. And it was not George Mallory who found the route, although historians credit him with it. It was actually Oliver Wheeler, who was mapping the inner massif, that found the opening to the East Rongbuk Glacier that, as it turned out, swept around to first the east and then come back toward the west to the base of the North Col. And that, incidentally, is the route that climbers take to this day who assault the mountain from the Tibetan side, from the north. Now, one of the fascinating things in the research for this book, you know, it was an incredible research process to track down the lives of all 26 of these men, not to mention to tell the story from the Tibetan side. So that involved spending months in monasteries with the spiritual heirs of those who were at Wrong Book in 1922, securing the spiritual autobiography of Zetsur Rinpoche, the charismatic abbot that Mallory and his men met in 1922 and 1924 at that Wrong Book glacier. And I also returned to Everest with Dorje Latu, who was the head of the Himalayan Mountaineering Institute, a relative of Tenzing Norgay, who climbed Everest with Hillary in 1953. And Dorje was a fantastic climber. He had trained all the modern Himalayan climbers from India. And so Dorje and I spent 2 or 3 months around the mountain climbing subsidiary peaks. I never wanted to climb Everest because I didn't want to be tempted to in any way have this book become a first-person account of the mountain. I wanted to keep myself completely out of this book and keep the story focused on the men. But in the course of all of that, I stumbled on some extraordinary documents. I visited 50 or more major archives around the world and also, of course, met with all the family members. And in 1921, and I think this is a great example to sort of show how the war carried, was fused in the sort of the fiber of the being of these men. In 1921, according to all Everest historians, only Guy Bullock, Mallory's climbing companion, kept a journal. It was kind of a curt thing that was published by the Alpine Club in the early 1960s. People talk about Mallory's journals, but he actually just wrote letters to his beloved wife, Ruth, and they're at Magdalen College. But I found this unsung hero of Everest, Oliver Wheeler. I found his son, John, then age 76, living, if you can believe it, five doors from the house I was born in Vancouver. He was Canadian. And I went to visit him, and in the course of a long afternoon, he suddenly pulled off his shelf two treasures, two fat journals kept by his father, Oliver, in 1921 as he marched across Everest with Mallory and the first expedition. These journals turned out to be a treasure trove. And curiously, on that approach march to Everest, Arthur Kellis, high-altitude physiologist, age 56, too old for Everest, literally died of exhaustion and was buried at the base of the Tibetan fortress of Kampazong. Now, in Wheeler's journal, on the day they buried Kellis, this is what he wrote. "Well, they buried the old boy in the morning. Thought it was going to be the afternoon. Terribly sorry to have missed it, but I do hate funerals." Well, wait a minute, David. How do you miss the interment of one of your fellow climbers that you're walking across Tibet with? There had to be something more to this. And I knew, of course, that the answer would lie on the Western Front. Wheeler was a soldier's soldier, and he was with the 7th MIR Division of the Indian Army went out to France at the outbreak of hostilities. And, of course, within 2 months of the beginning of the war, the entire British Expeditionary Force of four divisions had been annihilated. And so the entire British sector of the front in the fall of 1914 was held by the Canadians in the north and the Indian Corps in the south. By this point, the topography of Armageddon had come into place. The trench lines reached the coast, and both sides were beginning to sap each other, which meant putting trenches out at 90 degrees to get close to your enemy line. And it came to the attention of Wheeler's battalion that the Germans had put two saps within 30 feet of their front line, and he was given the orders as a Royal Engineer to go over the top with 125 men and bury the German sap and do so in a way that would dissuade the Germans from ever trying that technique again, at least on their sector of the front. On a dark night in November, he goes over the top. All hell breaks loose, artillery, machine gun fire, because it turns out that the saps that night are filled with Germans about to attack them. The result is this ferocious melee of hand-to-hand combat. Eventually, the Indians push the Germans back, but not before the sap or the trench is literally lined three bodies deep, chest to chest, boys of both sides flailing about in their death throes, as Wheeler would report, like trout in my creel. And he had no choice but to bury them alive. So when he says, on Everest, I do hate funerals. You know what he's gone through on the Western Front.
Yeah, it's boggling. It's really mind boggling to hear stories like that and to try to imagine what that would have been like. And then again, that just goes back to the base on which you're building the story and your argument that this for the world, but for particularly these men, these were the experiences that forged their character, that determined how they thought about life and death, and why it is that they would do something like want to do something like climb Everest.
And you know, it's important that you know, the fantastic thing is that these men were also of a generation of such dignity and grit. And certainly a generation of individuals who are not about to prepare to yield their feelings to analysis. You know, one of the things we forget is that the topsy-turvy world of chaos that the war, in a sense, unleashed on the 20th century, it's one of the reasons we sort of came to comfortably accept the profound revelations of Darwin, of Freud, of Einstein. You know, those were pretty transformative theories that each of those three men were putting forth. They found root in the 20th century that they might not have as readily found roots in the 19th century. And so it's, but these men were still children of the 19th century in a sense, and they did not yield their feelings to analysis. And that gives them this immense dignity and grit. But when you just look at what happened to them, for example, Howard Somerville was a surgeon at a casualty clearing station behind the front, and on the eve of the Battle of the Somme in July of 1916, he was told that he and the seven other surgeons who worked this field hospital, two men to a six-hour shift, 24 hours around the clock, could perhaps expect 1,000 casualties in the first week of the battle. He walked out on July 1st, the first day of the battle, onto his shift and found himself surrounded by 6 acres of dying boys on stretchers or lying on the ground, stacked about, as one said, like cordwood. He had to decide which would die, who would live, and who he might be able to save. And when he went to Everest, he never returned. He became a medical missionary in the south of India, devoting the rest of his life to saving the living, that he might sweep away all memories of the dead.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Wade Davis. We're talking about his great new book, Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory, and the Conquest of Everest. And we'll talk more after a very short break. This is Focus.
Support comes from the Illinois Symphony Orchestra in Ecstatic and Exotic, with harpist Bridget Kabi in Rodrigo's Concierto, Serenata, and Scheherazade, with guest conductor Ray Hotoda, February 24th at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts and the 25th at Sangamon Auditorium in Springfield. Details at ilsymphony.org.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon with 10 different topics every week. You can check the schedule by going to our website. That's will.illinois.edu. On the program Monday, we'll have another conversation with a candidate in the March primary. We're doing a number of these in the run-up to the primary here in the state on the 20th. And our guest Monday at 10 o'clock will be Tom Plura. He's a Republican candidate for the Illinois State Senate in the 51st District. Then in the second part of the program on Monday, we'll be talking with two documentary filmmakers, Ashar and Basma Qureshi, both of them former employees of CNN. They worked in the Pakistan Bureau, and they have produced a very interesting movie, which is set in Dearborn, Michigan. And the title of their documentary is Fordson Faith Fasting Football. And it is about a mostly Muslim football team in Dearborn, Michigan, getting ready for a big game while fasting for Ramadan. And it has a lot to say about the lives of Muslims in America. The movie will be shown on Monday night, next Monday night, at the Art Theater in Champaign, just one showing at 7 o'clock. And that'll be followed by a discussion of life in post-9/11 America for Muslim Americans. So you might want to take in the movie, and we'll be talking all about it on the program Monday. We're here, as I say, weekday mornings from 10 until noon, 10 different topics every week. You get the schedule by going to the website, which is will.illinois.edu. In this hour of focus, the guest is Wade Davis. He is a best-selling author of more than a dozen books. He currently holds the post of National Geographic Explorer in Residence and is author of this new book. We're talking about the title of his book is Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory and the Conquest of Everest. Knopf is the publisher. Today, people climbing Everest, certainly it's no small thing, but you do at least have the advantage that you're following in the footsteps of other climbers, and you can take advantage of the best technology in climbing equipment, clothing, and so forth. These guys, they did not have either of those advantages. And in fact, as I understand it, there was a big controversy among climbers about whether they would even use supplemental oxygen. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the technical challenges and how they tried to meet them.
Yes, I mean, you know, one of the old sort of cliches, David, about the expedition, which of course is the very image that sort of captivated me initially, was sort of these Englishmen in tweeds flinging themselves against the ice. Well, the truth of the story is that they had the very best equipment that was available at the time. They certainly were acutely aware of the need to dress in layers. George Finch, who was a chemist, a scientist, probably the finest climber of ice and snow, who was on the 22 expedition, famously invented the down coat. Even if he was to be ridiculed by his mates, he was the one who stayed warm. So they had and were constantly working on the equipment. That said, there remained incredible uncertainties. I mean, first of all, climbing in the Himalaya was like anything they had experienced in the Alps. You know, famously it said on the slopes of Everest that the upper half of your body can be suffering from heat stroke while the lower half of your body is suffering from frostbite. Mm. And probably the weakest part of their equipment would have been their boots, you know, these sort of leather boots with nails into the leather to hold the soles on. That probably would have brought cold into the feet. They did suffer in that regard. But things like oxygen weren't quite so simple as those for or against it. On the one hand, you had a lot of sort of individuals back in London, members of the Everest Committee, the committee put together from leading figures of both the Royal Geographical Society and the Alpine Club, individuals like the sort of Svengali of the entire effort, Arthur Hinks, who was a bureaucrat who had never been in the field. He had certainly never climbed anything higher than his desk. He led the charge against oxygen, thinking that it was not sporting. The more scientifically inclined climbers were quite right in saying that seeking supplemental oxygen was no different in kind than seeking the best pair of boots for the mountain. But one of the things that was going on and how this mountain became a turning point in climbing history is that before the war, climbing was very much a sport of gentlemen. And the climbers on Everest, if those who had not been at the front, who had not been to Everest, used the language of war to describe mountain climbing, assaults on the mountain, turning the flank of a mountain, conquering a mountain. The men who actually went to Everest had lived through a war which had allowed them to dance along the edge of death so profoundly that they were willing to accept risks that would have been unimaginable before the war. And indeed, they spoke explicitly, as Somerville Finch, about the need on Everest to be prepared to drive yourself to the point of obliteration if you wanted to get up this mountain. But the oxygen controversy was a bit more complicated than that, because it wasn't simply a matter of those who thought it was sporting versus those unsporting versus those who thought it was just a practical aid. So little was known about it. Nobody knew, for example, what would happen if you were using supplemental oxygen at high elevation and something went wrong with the apparatus. And so it was a technical challenge, but it was met in 1922. And the controversy was essentially put to bed by the remarkable success in 1922 of George Finch. On that expedition, which was the first to actually attempt to get up the North Col, to climb the mountain, it was from the start conceived that there would be climbing parties with oxygen and some without. But because of the chaos that invariably convulsed these expeditions, once they actually came to close quarters with the mountain, conditions that were not predictable, in 1922, the second-in-command, a man called Colonel Strutt, rather foolishly authorized George Mallory to take three of the best climbers, Colonel Norton, Moorshead, and Howard Somerville, on a single all-out assault on the summit, four men climbing together. They had a disastrous climb. They would have all died had Mallory not done a heroic self-arrest as the three of them, as the three others, glissaded in out of control down a steep slope of ice when one of them fell. But they all came back severely debilitated. Norton had lost part of his ear. Moorshead, in the end, would lose several fingers. Even Mallory suffered frostbite. Only the indomitable Howard Somerville was physically unscathed. But at that point, none of them understood that there were no second efforts on Everest, no second attempts. It was so exhausting, so debilitating, that one really had one shot at the mountain on an expedition. So what that meant is that having put all the eggs in one basket, Strutt had authorized this expedition or this assault, and which only resulted in the complete exhaustion of most of his climbing men. So by the time that George Finch recovered from a terrible bout of dysentery and was prepared to take a crack at the mountain, there were literally no climbers left. And so he chose General Bruce, who led the expedition. His cousin on the expedition, Jeffrey Bruce, transport officer, had never been on a mountain in his life, was recruited by Finch, and the two of them, setting off with oxygen, surpassed Mallory's height record of the previous week and might well have summited the mountain had the weather conditions not proved to be so dreadful that they were stuck in bivouac for 2 days. And it was really to save Jeffrey Bruce's life that Finch abandoned that climb. But before he did so, he set an undeniable height record and also proved the complete efficacy and utility of oxygen. So after that, oxygen was never really a question.
I want to, we're coming down to, we have about 5 minutes left, and part of the story here is also the Tibetan story, the story of the Sherpas. And it's interesting, it's sort of my understanding that here, maybe surprisingly, that the Sherpas hadn't done a lot of climbing, and in fact, they thought that the British were mad for wanting to do it.
Yes, I mean, you know, from the Tibetan point of view, you know, the most important, the notion of a hero in Tibet is a bodhisattva. It's the individual who has followed the contemplative path of the Tibetan Buddhist tradition and achieved in his lifetime transformation and enlightenment, and yet decides to stay in the realm of samsara to facilitate the liberation of all sentient beings. The whole purpose of one's life is to achieve that point of liberation, and you can only do so through conscious meditation. So the idea of climbing into the death zone where oxygen deprivation alone obliterates all opportunities for life and indeed for conscious reflection, only to climb in a body of rock is, to the Tibetan point of view, about the dumbest thing you could possibly do. Also, all of these mountains, you know, you hear a lot about how Everest was a sacred mountain, Shomen Lungma, goddess mother of the world. I mean, that designation must have come from the back of a celestial seasoning tea package, because Everest was in fact not a sacred mountain. In fact, it had been quelled. It was a mountain deity, like all mountains, but it had been tamed by Guru Rinpoche when he spent 8 months in the Rongbuk Valley at the time in which he transmitted the Dharma to Tibet. And because of that, it was precisely because of that Sherpa were prepared to go up Everest. By the same token, the Rongbuk Monastery did not exist from time immemorial. It actually had been built in the first decades of the 20th century by the charismatic Lama Zatra Rinpoche, who was able to build these monasteries both in Tibet and across the Nangpala in Nepal and the Solokumbu because of the new wealth that had been generated in that farming society by the introduction of the potato into those valleys in the 1870s by the British. What is fascinating is that during the time of Guru Rinpoche, he had sown these sacred treasures, treasures which were seen as guidebooks to enlightenment, guidebooks that existed both in literal space and metaphysical space across the entire range of the Himalaya. And these were the famous hidden valleys that gave rise to this notion we have of Shangri-La. And so what this really implied is that the, in terms of Tibetan notions of sacred geography, Everest itself wasn't some sacred mountain, but the entire time the British were exploring its environs, they were walking through mystic space. Mm-hmm. And the Sherpa would never have had occasion to climb onto the top of a mountain, there was no point in doing so. So although eventually the Sherpa would emerge as the key force upon which all future expeditions would rest, in the early days it was literally the British, as Mallory did, training the Sherpa in the techniques of climbing and ice work.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that, you know, people have long argued that Ed Hillary probably would not have made it in 53 had he had not had Tenzing Norgay with him. Well, that there the tradition of Sherpa climbers really goes back to the British in the 20s, and they're teaching those techniques to the Tibetans.
Right, it was very much a symbiotic relationship where again, these ethnic peoples are not frozen in time, as we all always seem to think. I mean, the Sherpa were very dynamic individuals. Of course, they were Tibetans originally, and they had really done very well as merchants, which is what brought so many of them to Darjeeling, where they first came to the attention of Arthur Kellis, the high-altitude physiologist who died at Camp Azong, as I mentioned earlier in the program, but also had spent most of his life in the Himalayas, spending more time on more mountains than virtually any other European. So he was the one who first noticed the unique characteristics of the Sherpa that proved so helpful on the mountain. But it was very much a symbiotic kind of relationship.
Mm. So just very quickly here to finish up, you tell the story of how on this day, I think it was in June of 1924, Mallory and Sandy Irvin go off. One of the members watches them walk off, and then, of course, they vanish. And no one for 75 years, no one knew what happened to them until the bodies were found. And I know you've said that the question that everybody wants to know is not really the question that interests you.
Well, no, but everybody does want to know whether Mallory got to the top. And of course, Sandy Irvin's body has yet to be found, and there's efforts to find it right now as we speak, and that's not something the families are particularly keen on. George Mallory's body was found in 1999, 3 months after I signed the contract to write this book, and you can imagine, David, there were 10 books out by fall. Yet it was really a gift because it forced me to take my book to a level of depth and breadth that I might not have otherwise done.
Yeah.
That's why it took 12 years of research. You know, nothing that was found in 1999 really helped us answer the fundamental question whether Mallory could have gotten to the top or not. The key impediment is the so-called second step, which includes about 100-foot, 120-foot sheer piece of rock exposed on both sides 10,000 feet down to the Kenshin face on the east and the Rongbuk Glacier on the west. It's highly unlikely that Sandy Irvin could have made that climb, let alone George Mallory. There's any number of pieces of evidence suggesting that they were severely debilitated. They had lost their stove. They couldn't melt water. They're dehydrated. It seems like they left at dawn for that final climb when a modern climber would have left at 2 a.m. and still taken perhaps till 9 p.m. to get back. It seems extremely unlikely. It's certainly unlikely and inconceivable that Mallory would have abandoned young Sandy Irvin on the mountain and tried to make a personal assault, not in his character to do so.
Hmm.
The one enticing thing is that had the snows that pounded the 1924 expedition, forcing Colonel Norton to retreat not once but three times from the very base of the North Col, had those snows accumulated as they on the northeast ridge as they had down below, it's conceivable that an incline of snow could have formed that essentially would have buried the impediment, and the men could have simply walked up the snow. Now, such an accumulation of snow did happen at the second step in the fall of 1986, and albeit in the autumn, but had that happened, it's not inconceivable that Mallory would have gone right to the top of the second step at the speed that Noah O'Dell famously reported, in which case nothing would have kept him from getting to the summit of Everest.
Will, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're simply going to have to stop. It's such a great story. There's so much more. I would certainly suggest that people look to the book Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory and the Conquest of Everest, published by Knopf, by our guest Wade Davis. He's National Geographic Explorer in Residence. And Wade, thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure, David.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Radio Maria in downtown Champaign. Along with their dinner menu, tapas is served every evening until 2 a.m. Brunch is also served on Saturday and Sunday from 10:30 to 2:30. Information on menus and wine and beer lists is at RadioMariaRestaurant.com.
We'll take a break here, as we usually do, and then we'll have more focus. Jeff Bossert will be in the chair here for hour two, talking a little bit about this weekend's upcoming Academy Awards ceremony. First, however, we'll take a break for an update on the market. Stay tuned.
Support for Stock and Commodity Reports on Illinois Public Media comes from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign, now hosting risk management seminars. A complete list of seminars is at sfarmmarketing.com.
And I'm Jim Meadows with a look at these commodity market readings. Hard red winter wheat for March is at 673 and a quarter. It is down 6 3/4. Hard red winter wheat for May at 680 and a quarter, down 6 3/4. Looking at wheat for March, it's trading at 637, down 4 3/4. May wheat is trading at 637, down 4. March corn is at 638 and a quarter. It's down 1 1/4. May corn at 630 3/4, down 1 3/4. Corn for July at 642 3/4, down 2. April crude oil is at 108.33, up 50 cents.